This is Talk is Cheap. I'm your host, DJ Susty, on KPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peace Works Independent Community Radio. Are continuing on with the Citizens for Climate Lobby 2022 conference. This is Alex Flint, a self-proclaimed conservative. One thing I notice, he blames government rather than corporations. I just want to point out, in my own opinion, the state works for corporations, and this is yet an example of what is wrong with corporations, is they put things in motion and then they can't change direction, and they should have retooled long ago and gotten off of fossil fuels, but they stay with the momentum and don't change, and that's the inherent problem with corporations. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends.
Two things: to provide conservative leadership on climate, to advance American growth, and reduce CO2 emissions. Alex has been a steadfast leader in this area. He was formerly staff director of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, and I believe senior vice president of the Nuclear Institute. But that doesn't really go to the extent of his knowledge and experience. It doesn't speak to the years and years he spent working in the Senate, working in nuclear power, the hundreds of bills that he has helped pass and had input into. And I have to say, like, Alex and AMS has been one of the greatest allies of CCL as we seek a carbon price. And honestly, like, when we are thinking of big questions, one of the first people we call is Alex. He's at the very top of that list. And so I know I will not, any introduction I could do would not do him justice. So I will shut up and bring on Alex, and we're very happy to have him. Thank you very much.
Well, this works as well, so I can wander around? Perfect. I've just had an exhilarating drive from Richmond, and it's going to take me a while. I have a daughter who swims, and there was a meet in Richmond this morning, so at 5 we headed down there, and she swam, and something took 2 minutes and 46 seconds, which was better than 2 minutes and 51 seconds. And then I enjoyed the drive back, and it was thrilling to get here on time. Oh, not because it was fast, but because it was slow. I'm really quite honored to be here. A keynote talk at the Citizens Climate Lobby is a big deal to me. I have been in Washington for 32 years. I believe that Washington is one of the most complex systems of influence in the world. And I think CCL plays a key role in that. Recognize that there are people like me who spend almost every waking moment trying to figure out how to get certain things across finish lines. Every interest you can imagine has advocates in Washington, and remarkable resources flow into that space. I suspect that if you are anything like me, you are constantly aware of the limits of your resources, the limits of your influence, the limitations of yourselves individually and as an organization. I watch climate work from my perspective, let's put it this way. when I compare CCL to the Environmental Defense Fund and the NRDC and the Sunrise Movement and the Chamber of Commerce, I think you have a uniquely influential position and role that you have put together. The grassroots, the engagement, the volunteer nature of what you do, I think you are one of the most important groups working on climate. And so while, so I'm going to share some remarks that I hope are among friends who share a common goal and who can speak frankly to one another so that we can sort of make sure we're working in the same reality. When I first started thinking about a keynote address, I wanted to do something grand. I wanted an exhortation, and so I went and I read some recent speeches by important people about climate. On April 4th, Secretary General Antonio Guterres said, "The jury has reached a verdict, and it is damning. This report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is a litany of broken climate promises. It is a file of shame, cataloging the empty pledges that put us firmly on track towards an unlivable world. We are on a fast track to climate disaster. Major cities are underwater, unprecedented heat waves, terrifying storms, widespread water shortages, the extinction of a million species of plants and animals. This is not fiction or exaggeration. It is what science tells us will result from our current energy policies. We are on a pathway to global warming of more than double the 1.5 Celsius limit agreed in Paris. Some government and business leaders are saying one thing but doing another. Simply put, they are lying, and the results will be catastrophic. This is a climate emergency." I thought I'd have a hard time topping that. So I also looked up what Greta Thunberg has said recently and what Leonardo DiCaprio has said recently, because I realized I wanted to appeal to lots of people today. And then I had this realization that I am not Leonardo DiCaprio. And so I decided not to do something grand, not to do an exhortation. You probably don't need an exhortation. You came here to spend the weekend and spend the next couple of days working on this because you already understand what the Secretary General and Greta Thunberg and Leonardo DiCaprio are saying. So instead, I'm going to start with a very different sort of quote. It happens to hang on a banner in one of my daughter's rooms. I have four kids. "I've learned that people will forget what you said, people will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel." Maya Angelou. I'd like to try to bring that spirit into my remarks today. And my counsel is that you should bring that spirit into your work as you meet with politicians. Remember that this is a very human effort to save the world that we live on. And while we, and I can tell you there are lots of differences between you and me and every politician I've ever met, in the end, we are humans with much in common, most things in common, and hopefully we can identify shared values and listen to each other so that we can be productive in this effort to address climate change. Let me give you a little bit more background on me than what Ben did. Ben was more than generous, but I'm a kid who, when I was 18, got a job working for a senator. That's how I paid for college. So I've been at this now for 34 years in Washington. I have written 70 things that are law. I've worked on about 70 confirmations of cabinet secretaries and other sorts of people like that. I've had several jobs in government. I have been the person who ends up standing in a room full of members of the House, senators, doing big deals with a yellow pad of paper, usually with a bunch of things on it, crossed out, circled, checks, and going, "Congressman, if we do this, but we leave this out, and Senator will put this in, and you'll do this on another bill, do we have a deal?" And that's the perspective I hope to share of somebody that I refer to as sort of a legislative mechanic. Now, it's not all great and glorious. Because I have 45 minutes, I'll share one anecdote from doing that sort of thing. When the House and the Senate pass separate versions of a bill, occasionally, the old-fashioned way of resolving those differences is to have a conference negotiation between the House and the Senate. And I've been the lead staffer on several of those. During one, and there's actually, it's interesting, there's actually a set of official papers. And you have a conference agreement when the majority of the House conferees and the majority of the Senate conferees sign the back of the official documents. And in this one particular case, I was the person with the official documents. We thought we had a deal, but I didn't yet have the signatures, particularly the House members, on the document. I'm driving the camera guy crazy, I know. But the drive was really exciting, so it's just gonna have to bear me. Okay, sorry about that. So I start walking among the House members saying, Congressman, will you sign the conference report, needing to get to 50% of the House conferees? I come up to one congressman, he says, no. I said, Congressman, why not? I thought we, he said, you didn't put in the provision I asked for. I said, Congressman, I don't know what provision you're talking about. And he said, the time change provision. I said, Congressman, nobody's talked to me about the time change, the daylight savings provision, nobody's talked to me about this. He said, I'm telling you, we're trying to save energy. If we change the daylight savings date, there will be more sunshine, more crops, it'll be brighter during the day. And I said, Congressman, I don't think it actually makes the sun stay up longer. He said, yes, it will make more light. Don't you understand this? And that will make us save energy because we won't have to have the lights on so much. I said, Congressman, if we put this in, will you sign the contract? Yes. That's why we changed daylight savings in 2005. So I'm a legislative mechanic, but it's not all good lessons, okay? I have some sayings that I've learned along the way. Never take a knife to a gunfight. I think the one that has become my governing mantra, never attribute to conspiracy what may have been accomplished through incompetence. I can go on and on. But let me tell you where I think we are in climate space. So I was involved when the House and the Senate passed Waxman-Markey and then did various variations of cap and trade in the Senate. And I was asked to help try to figure out what the vote count was. Now that was an authorization bill, so to break a filibuster, they needed 60 votes in the Senate. And when you're trying to do that sort of thing, you need to get to 55 to 56 to start horse trading. Because nobody wants to trade to be the 42nd vote for something. So we went in there to try to understand what the vote count was and to do some horse trading. I don't think cap and trade legislation had more than 43 votes in the Senate. We were that far from getting cap and trade legislation across. When President Obama, and particularly John Podesta, who was a very good strategic thinker, recognized that the Congress was not going to legislate on climate change, they adopted a strategy of multinational commitments through the Paris Agreement and executive action through the use of the CAFE standards, the Clean Air Act, and every other standard and existing law regulation, most of which were derivative of laws written in the 1970s when we had the post-Arab oil embargo energy crisis. But that, since the that year, has really been the U.S. government's strategy for addressing climate. Nationally determined commitments per the Paris Agreement, and executive branch action. Now, we saw the frailty of executive branch action when President Trump came to office and unwound a lot of those efforts. But I think when the Supreme Court rules in West Virginia versus EPA that this Supreme Court is likely to say, and I, by the way, I log on every morning when the Supreme Court issues its opinions because we should expect it any day now, I suspect this Supreme Court is going to have a conservative interpretation of executive branch authority, and meaning you can't use the Clean Air Act even as President Obama wanted to, but certainly not in a broad enough, expansive enough way to adequately address climate change. I also think that the Paris commitments are stumbling. We're seeing that particularly as a consequence of the Ukraine war. I have friends who say, I can't wait to get back to normal, to when we don't have to worry about the energy aspects of the energy and climate discussion so much, but I think what the Ukraine situation has done is for a lot of people who thought climate was easy, is it has revealed how actually very difficult it is. This is the reality. We are dependent upon energy. We are still dependent upon fossil fuels. It is going to take a much larger transformation of global economies than I think can be accomplished through the Paris Agreement sort of mechanism. And so we're at this point, call it, are we 30 years into working on climate? Something like that. We all know the details of the political divisions and the difficulties and who's to blame and who's not to blame, and we could do that, except I'm trying to be friendly. But if we're not making adequate progress on a multinational basis through the Paris Agreement, and we're about to see a massive limitation on executive branch authorities, and the Congress is still unable to pass climate legislation, we're almost at a do-over point. And I say that, that's one of those cup half full, cup half empty sort of statements. It clearly is disappointing that we did not make enlightened decisions about climate decades ago. I do not think we are on the verge of enacting adequate climate policy. But what it also means is that we are, I think, can approach this as at the beginning. We can think about where we are and what the optimum policies are and how we might best pursue those policies over the coming years, and unfortunately it will take us years. But we have sort of the opportunity for a fresh look, for an examination of the horizon, an understanding of what we've learned the last 30 years. And we have to recognize that we are going to be working at this for years to come. I think for me, adequate, responsible climate policies might hopefully be achieved when my kids are at the prime of their career. It's not going to happen early. I've got four kids in college starting this fall. I am worried that they are going to graduate from college in a world that still has not figured out how to deal with climate change. Okay. In the near term, Kevin McCarthy thinks Republicans are going to gain 40 seats in the House this fall. I don't know if he is right, but that is the political reality because he and a bunch of other people think that is right. I have been working now for 5 years to convince Republicans to address climate change. I think we have had some success in eliminating denialism from Republican climate orthodoxy. I have been trying to convince Republicans that a carbon tax appeals to traditional conservative values and conservative economics. The rise of populism and opposition to free trade and other elements in my Republican Party have pushed that agenda back. This is not the same Republican Party from a decade or two decades ago when it comes to economic policy. I was at a little event that Jonathan Martin and Alexander Burns, Jonathan Martin's a reporter at the New York Times, they have a book out, This Will Not Pass, which is, if you like to read the book of the week or book of the month about the dysfunction in Washington, it's a pretty good example, very good example, I should say. One of the people in the audience said, is Trump going to run for president again? And Jonathan said, you know, we get asked that at every book event that we do. Almost every book event, we also get asked, is Joe Biden running for president again? And he turned to those of us present, and he said, you all don't listen very well. They have both said they're running for president. You have this hope that maybe they'll drop out, one or the other, whoever you hope for or against. I'm not trying to be partisan here. You even think maybe when their names are on the ballot that they will drop out, which could happen, for all I know. I don't know. I do not know. That's our political reality, though, when we look at the elections in 2022 and 2024 until something changes. And I am very fearful that if Republicans take over the House in 2022 and then we have a contested election in 2024, it is very difficult to see how climate policy rises to the top of agenda and we have engagement from politicians at the level necessary. There are other things that our friends care about, be it unemployment, be it inflation, high energy prices, other things that make it very hard for politicians to focus on climate. I want to have a word about woke corporations. I'm an old-fashioned conservative Republican in many ways, and in recent years, as Republicans have changed their positions on things, I've really had to plumb my values to understand what that means. My sense of conservatism, I believe, is derived from a sense of responsibility. I am the person who literally over-insures my cars, my house, my life, oversaves for my kids' college education, because I feel a sense of responsibility for things in the world. You don't have to prove to me that the climate is going to change. You simply have to say there is a very significant risk the climate is going to change, and I will seek to mitigate that risk. I think that those sorts of values that has never received an applause before. that you shook me just a little bit. I'm gonna have to think about that a bit. That actual little thing about my values is derived from a rant that I went on one time, pacing back and forth in my office, complaining about every sort of politician you can imagine. And my communications director, Meredith Davis, started writing and distilled 30 minutes of me pacing back and forth into what I just recounted to you. And that was a lovely response to that. Meredith will be thrilled. Woke corporations. So I'm an old-fashioned Republican in many ways. I'm a capitalist. I respect the role of corporations in providing the goods and services that benefit my life and employing people and adding value to the economy. I tend to sympathize with corporate executives, so understand that bearing. I think something really is interesting is going on. So politicians are becoming increasingly dependent upon narrow subsets of voters to get reelected. We can certainly look at the House and redistricting, where it's not all the voters in a district who make a difference. It's the ones that show up in that member's primary and determine who the nominee is going to be for the office, because the district is a safe Republican or a safe Democrat district, right? We all know that stuff. So our elected Democratic officials are actually becoming dependent upon smaller and smaller groups of constituents in order to have their elected offices. I'm seeing sort of an opposite of phenomena with corporate leaders, who increasingly have diverse employees, are selling to diverse groups of customers, who have diverse interests among their investors, their shareholders, who are thinking about global markets that, particularly in the climate space, are beginning to implement policies. And these corporate leaders are, in my mind, taking views on climate that I think are actually more representative of the people as a whole than some of these elected officials, who you would think represent the people, but actually, because the way our system is working right now, represent smaller and smaller slices. And so I see some of these CEOs talk about climate, and I think it's actually a better approach than I'm seeing from some elected officials. I'm so intrigued about this that I certainly take very seriously the notion that maybe corporations are going to lead on climate and the government is going to be the laggard. Okay. You got to stop applauding at things like that, because this is a very unique group of people, okay? You are not like the others. You are not like the others. Okay, that's good. There are days when I think that should be comforting, that in a democracy, the government waits for a consensus among all the people before it legislates. I have to say I had been hoping that the government would lead on climate, but I am spending a lot of time now thinking about a different strategic transformation that could occur. Oh, and I'll put a fine point on it. I was involved in organizing a meeting where a bunch of Republican members of Congress got together to talk about climate change, a secret meeting, so to speak. It was in the papers. I won't say what the meeting was. I think that's enough of a protecting the commitments. Okay. We had organized to have what I thought were Republican luminaries address the group of Republican members of Congress, and one was from the Chamber of Commerce. And I thought, and the Chamber of Commerce person set up and said something, I can't remember the quotes now, we acknowledge climate change, inaction is not an option, or something like that, is the Chamber's statement about climate change. Republican member of Congress leans over next to me and says, excuse me, I have pledged not to curse, which does leave me just unable to say things sometimes, but leans over next to me and goes, Republican member of Congress, F the Chamber. That is an important element among Republicans today that we have to keep in mind as we think about how to put deals together. I thought convincing Republicans that corporate America wanted climate action would be tremendously impactful. In the secretary, another topic, how to talk about climate change. First, Danny and Ben are two of my favorite collaborators on how to approach congressional staff and members of Congress about climate change. So after I make this suggestion about how to talk to members of Congress and their staffs about climate change, because I know you're gonna be doing that, if Danny and Ben have a different view of it, wherever you are, just stand up, chime in. I do not talk about degrees Celsius. There is no member of Congress who can quickly enough multiply by 5, divide by 8, and add 32. I really think that a lot of people who talk about that think, oh, this is my most impactful point, and that it's like this, it's like a static point in the conversation because it makes no impact. Fahrenheit. Talk about Fahrenheit. I also think that the scientific community does itself a disservice when it talks about, and I'm going to do it in Celsius because this is how the scientific community does it, about a 1.5 and 2 degrees Celsius goal. It's like me talking about my goal of running a 3-hour marathon. Okay? I don't run. Okay? I'm never going to run a 3-hour marathon. But just saying it makes it almost sound possible. Okay? I like the MIT En-ROADS model. MIT, the University, okay, the En-ROADS model, okay. Okay. Yeah, you've done it again, because when I pop up my iPad and go, okay, we're gonna spend 5 minutes doing climate modeling, that's not normally the response I get. I love that model. If I'm correct right now, it shows we are on track. I do it in imperial units, and I do the sea level rise chart. So degrees Fahrenheit and sea level. It shows we're on track for a 6.5 degree Fahrenheit increase by 2100 and 36 to 40 inches of sea level rise by 2100. And I think that's what we need to talk about. That is our baseline. Not 1.5 to 2 degrees Celsius, some aspirational goal that nobody actually understands because they don't understand what Celsius means. We are on track to experience a 6.5 degree Fahrenheit rise in global temperature accompanied by about a 36 to 40 inch rise in sea level. That is our baseline. We can adjust that up or we can adjust that down depending upon what we do. That's the way I think we need to talk about climate change. I want to talk about fiscal issues for just a little bit. The fiscal primers. For those of you who'd like to take a deeper dive, I think the Committee for a Responsible Budget, Maya McGinnis, is the master, the expert on federal fiscal matters. She may be the one person who has a harder job than any of us, because convincing the government to be fiscally responsible may actually be harder than convincing the government to be climate responsible. The basics, until the pandemic, the government collected $3.5 trillion a year in taxes and spent about $4.5 trillion a year. That's how we ended up with trillion-dollar year deficits. At the time, low 20s debt. During the pandemic, we doubled the deficit, more than doubled the deficit in several years. The debt is now $30 trillion. We're still collecting about $1 trillion or less in taxes every year than we spend. I hate taxes. By the way, my bumper sticker about a carbon tax is, if we enact a carbon tax, I'm going to encourage all my friends not to pay it. Don't pay the carbon tax. Okay? But understand that the federal government is $30 trillion in debt. Okay. My theory is that at some point the government is going to start acting like a debtor, acting like an entity that is fiscally constrained. And I don't mean responsible, I mean actually fiscally constrained in what it can do. Another thing that needs some attention. I'm a big supporter of the European Union moving forward with carbon border adjustment mechanisms. Okay. This has become sort of a topic in Washington recently. I see at least one reporter in the room. Are there other reporters in the room? Okay, then I'll speak a little bit more freely. I think you do a carbon tax and you attach a border adjustment mechanism to protect domestic industry to charge a carbon cost on goods that are imported, which creates an incentive for our trading partners to also reduce their carbon emissions. And to me, that's the way you use markets and the largest consumer economy in the world to drive not just reduction in carbon emissions here, but worldwide. I get particularly excited if people start talking about the EU and the United States and Canada and Australia and other Western democracies entering into agreements to impose a cost on carbon and have border adjustment mechanisms to drive the rest of the global economy to emulate our behavior. That's fantastic. I do think putting a carbon border adjustment mechanism in place without a carbon price is, on the one hand, technically very tricky, and on the other hand, the talk of Washington right now. And I mean that quite sincerely. Like, that is maybe the most interesting climate conversation in Washington. I have decided to jump into that conversation, despite having approached it from the old-fashioned way, which was, we're going to do a carbon price and it's going to have a border adjustment mechanism. Now I'm very willing to talk about having a border adjustment mechanism that somehow eventually leads to a carbon price, even though it's a challenge. But I would encourage you to be open to that, because when you talk to members of Congress and staff, they're going to be talking about that. You need to sort of get yourself like comfortable that you might do that, that there's a dog attached to that tail somewhere. Quick comments. My experience working to get cap and trade passed led me to believe that you can't do it. That climate, and that's a problem with cap and trade, and the deals that get made to get you votes, but then end up undermining the integrity of the system, which is then a justification for people not supporting the system, and you kind of get into this spot where you just can't gain enough votes to get across the finish line. But it also made me think that a solution to climate change itself may not have the votes necessary to pass the Congress. It's not a big enough issue. I became a carbon tax supporter because I saw it as solving two problems. One was climate, and the second was fiscal issues. I think in the end, and I officially support a revenue neutral carbon tax because I hate taxes, but I also equally hate debts, and I also do politics for a living. And I think in the end, the reason a carbon tax may be achievable is because the government's going to need money. Okay? And I don't like paying taxes, remember that. And I don't like expanding the size of the government, but I also hate tax, I hate debt and deficits, so I'm willing to engage in that conversation. Today I see a convergence of a third pressure. So when I started this at AMS, I saw a convergence of the need to address climate with the need to address fiscal matters. Now I think the trading issues coming in as the EU proceeds with border adjustment mechanisms and other trading partners will naturally follow in their stead. I see this third vector, which is the trade vector, and I'm hoping they converge on a carbon tax. I am a little worried, though, that the reality of climate change, increased wildfires, increased hurricane intensity, other things, are going to be on us before we can constructively engage on climate. My kids are all swimmers. There's a lot of swimming analogies in my family. We could end up doggy paddling until we drown rather than figuring out how to swim. And I'm really increasingly worried about that, that in the next couple of years, we have to get on a path towards progress on this, or the derivatives of climate change may cause enough conflict that we don't solve this problem, with all the scary implications of that. Now, part of the reason I tell you about the three vectors that I see converging is because I think we're having a conversation among friends. I hope so. You applauded three times for things nobody else applauds for. I love reconciliation. I've written reconciliation provisions. It's a powerful tool. It's not good. I think it's most likely the way we're going to get climate policy. It's not good for a tax and dividend. It's good for a tax. And what I think CCL needs to do is engage in a really active discussion about what your values are and what your methods are and how you want to be influential and how you want to go about addressing climate. I realize coming in here and saying a fee and dividend is a challenging pairing when you look at the limitations of our legislative process. But I also think I'm among friends and we ought to have that conversation. I love the ideal. I love revenue neutral carbon taxes. This is a Congress that legislates changes in daylight savings in order to make the sun shine longer. If I'm looking at this right, I have gone 35 minutes of an allotted 45 minutes. Are there any questions? I see one question. Wow, that's great. Thank goodness. All right. I think you all have had a pretty good run of success talking about the rebate. I think Citizens Climate Lobby has had a pretty good run talking about their dividend proposal. I don't make light of that. If you look at the way the American political system operates right now, we have an entire government that promises more than it charges people every single year. So maybe what we should learn is sell the sizzle, right? You're going to get more money out of this than it's going to cost you. You can make a really good case, including to me, that that's the way to get climate policy across the finish line. I decided, my model is different though. So I'm at my best in small rooms. This is the biggest group I've talked to in a very long time. In small rooms, talking to people on the Ways and Means Committee and the Finance Committee, all they do is talk about taxes. Don't call something a fee to somebody who writes tax policy and tax laws for a living. They know all about the revenue. They understand what Medicare and Medicaid insolvency is all about. They understand that Social Security is going to start paying 80% of benefits in 2034, which, by the way, is a very important year to me vis-a-vis Social Security. I talk to people in the language that the tax writers talk, and I talk sort of directly about it. Carbon tax, starting at $35 a ton with a decent index, can raise over $1 trillion over 10 years. If you want a revenue raiser about that much, you got to get rid of the home mortgage interest deduction. You got to get rid of the health insurance deduction. These are the trade-offs that policymakers are talking about when they're at $1 trillion. I'm comfortable talking about it as a carbon tax because the people I'm trying to influence talk about tax policy all the time. But there might be other ways of doing it. The question was, I said, and he seemed to agree, that corporations are taking the lead on climate. How should we use that in our advocacy efforts? First of all, I'm comfortable with that statement. There are also some bad actors. There are some corporations who really are fighting this, who've just decided that they're going to be short-term players. I understand that. Um, I'll make a broad generality, and then I'll start with something specific. I think if Democrat members of Congress stopped beating up on corporations and threatening to increase the corporate rate, there could be a transformation of the political relationships between the private sector and Democrats. I think a lot of corporate leaders are liberal in their social thinking and have problems with Republicans only because have problems with Democrats only because Democrats keep threatening them with increases in the corporate tax rate. And I think Democrats have an opportunity right now, as Republicans have become, as Governor DeSantis takes on Disney World, which I thought maybe he could come out against baseball too and be president or something like that. I don't know quite how all that works. I think there's an opportunity in two ways to answer your question. I think Democrats and corporations could work together on climate policy through a carbon tax. And I am hoping that as we've seen Republicans shift against corporations, that they can shift back, that there's a better natural state. It will take 4, 6, 8 years for that to happen. Right now, there is fairly outright hostility between a lot of Republicans and corporate America and the Business Roundtable. I mean, you saw an article in the Wall Street Journal a couple of weeks ago where American Petroleum Institute and the Business Roundtable came out supporting a carbon tax and were criticized by Republican leadership in the House. I mean, I read that article and I just sit back and I think, what in the world? What in the world? American Petroleum Institute supports a carbon tax. Business Roundtable supports carbon price. Price is what the Business Roundtable supports. All right, other questions? I see
Alex,
one in the very back.
We're actually collecting questions on index cards. Oh. So if folks have questions, you can write them on the card. Someone will come pick them up, and then we'll read them out from the microphone here back in the back so everyone can hear.
Ooh, I don't know who that was. but I'll do whatever you tell me to.
All right, so our next question is, what is the Republican Conservative Climate Caucus doing? And this person is asking, will their proposals reduce emissions?
I'm a fan of John Curtis. My son is interning for John Curtis. If you go see John Curtis, say hello to my son, who's in there right now. I think John Curtis completely understands the challenge of climate change. I think John Curtis also does not want to be a one-man parade. To his credit, he talked to his colleagues. He is a wonderful person to talk to and say, what is Kevin McCarthy thinking? What's Steve Scalise thinking? What's Garrett Graves thinking? What's the future of this issue in the caucus? I think he's one of the most well-informed, and he does not want to chart, as I said, a one-man parade. Congressman Curtis came to the conclusion that Republicans needed to talk among themselves and figure out their position on climate before it was right for them to sit down and have bipartisan discussions about climate. I thought about it differently. One of the things I do is I host bipartisan groups of members of Congress. It's absolutely fascinating. I hosted a Republican and a Democrat for dinner at a table with some other members of Congress from adjoining districts in New York who both fly out of the same airport to and from Washington on roughly the same schedule and had never met each other before. And had a climate conversation. I think there needs to do, which to have, is have a discussion among Republicans. I do think that the efforts of the Conservative Climate Caucus in the House are missing an element, which is a goal. What is it they're trying to achieve? And I won't even propose what the metric should be by the goal. Is it some amount of deployment of net zero energy production? Is it some quartile economic efficiency based upon tons of CO2 produced per dollar of economic growth in the United States? Is it a net zero date? Is it, I don't know what it is. And I think they're having those discussions, but I think I'm a little worried that conversation, well, the quote I have in one of the trade rags is when asked about it the day they came out with their statement was, this responds to the politics of climate change. It is not an adequate response to the science of climate change. And before I go on any further and say things that I will have to apologize for tomorrow, I see, is there another question?
Yes, there are more questions. We're back here in the back.
Okay.
This next person is mentioning or pointing out that it's an election year, and they're wondering what impact is that having on the climate conversations you're a part of?
So I've been an advocate, and one of the things we do at AMS is we've done polling in specific congressional districts and focus group work to convince Republicans that they need to be able to be comfortable speaking about climate, acknowledging the reality of climate change and proposing climate solutions. And I will tell you, I've had fascinating experiences on this. When we first decided to do this about 4 years ago, we called a polling firm that was doing polling in a particular district that we cared about and said we'd like to get the climate questions answered or asked. And they said, hell, man, we agreed to a price. And then they said, and what are the questions? And I said, well, I want the standard climate question. And they said, we've never polled on climate before, which was its own. So I sat at my computer and wrote questions like, do you believe the climate's changing and all this sort of stuff. And then later that became questions that we then submit to other Republican pollsters to add to their polls, and we started, and now they are polling on climate a little bit more. It's been a remarkable shift in that arc over the last 4 years. And but the theory was, hold on. The theory was that there was a group of college-educated, younger, particularly women voters who cared about climate change, that they were the marginal voters in purple districts, and that those voters, if Republicans engaged productively on climate, could deliver victories to Republicans in purple swing districts, and then could provide the margins of victory necessary to win the House. I've been an advocate of that perspective for a number of years. With President Biden's popularity as low as it is right now, with inflation where it is, with gasoline prices where it is, I think there's another set of issues that swamp that, to be really frank. I mean, Kevin McCarthy thinks he's got 40 votes, 40 more seats coming in. That's a wave. And I think we have to think of, I think we have to keep the climate message going, but frankly, I'm not expecting the validation of people the day after the election saying because Republicans got better about climate, they did better. I think it's a longer term play. Next question.
All right, thank you, Alex. I think that's all we have time for. Okay. We're about at that time. So we'll turn it back over to you to wrap up.
Well, thank you all. I just want to conclude with where I started. I think we're in for a long effort. I think it's very hard to identify the metrics for success and the milestones because they are uncertain. I think we're going to be at this for years. Don't get discouraged. Don't. You can't. I mean, you have to wake up every morning and declare that the cup is half full. Okay? I'm worried that people may just check out of the American political process. The cup is half full. The way CCL works, the people like you who come to town, the relationships you have in the district and states, the way you tie that to engagements in Washington is powerful. I think you're doing a better job. Your methods and your people are more influential than many of the name brand major climate organizations. You play a uniquely important role. We're just going to have to recognize it's going to take a while. We're going to have to keep working at it. Thank you for letting me come by today. I appreciate it.
Pérage aux États-Unis dans la perspective des élections parlementaires de novembre. Deux personnes ont été tuées, 51 autres blessées aujourd'hui dans un attentat suicide à Mossoul, à 400 km au large de Bagdad.
Thank you.